Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Bava Kama Daf Pei Tes. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a specially marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage and then go to option 2. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur will begin two lines from the bottom of Daf Pei Ches Amud Beis. Once again, two lines from the bottom of Daf Pei Ches Amud Beis. In our previous shiur, we introduced the idea of Takonas Usha. Without getting into the details of our previous shiur, let us mention that Takonas Usha is a rabbinic enactment that we know primarily from Amoraic sources, specifically the words of Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina that we saw at the very end of our last shiur, that says that a woman who brings into her marriage properties from her father that her father granted her that are termed nichsei melug. Those are properties that the husband will have a right to benefit from its production, but he doesn't own the principal of the land. In the event that the woman attempts to sell those lands to someone else during their marriage, the husband has a right to take the lands away from the purchaser. The way it's phrased in the Gemara, three lines from the bottom, it says, "Ba'usha hiskinu ha'isha shemachar b'nichsei melug b'chayi ba'alu meisa ha'ba'al motzi mi'ad ha'lukuchas." That a woman who sells those nichsei melug during the lifetime of her during her lifetime while married, and then she dies, the husband has a right to take those properties back from whomever had purchased it from her. The way the husband is viewed as a lokeach rishon. He's viewed as the purchaser with first rights to it. So that the Takonas Usha entitles the husband to retrieve the properties from those who bought it from the wife during her lifetime. At this point in the Gemara, two lines from the bottom, you'll notice a marking, a geometric shape, a bow tie shape, on the side of the Gemara, under our Mivneh, under our structural note. We indicate the following. Misyonos laharos. These are attempts to show the Takonas Usha, the Isha Shemochra, etc., the Ba Motzim Yana Lukuchos, Yeshlo Basis B'Mekuruz Tanoim. We're going to try to show that it has a basis in Tanaic literature. So you'll see that the bow tie appears here. On Pei Tes Amud Aleph, in the middle of the Omid, you will notice another bow tie, where the Gemara is continuing with this attempt. So now we turn to the Gemara. Omar Rav Idi Bar Ovin, Af Anan Nami Tanina. We have also learned, meaning we saw Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina in our previous shiur introduce the Takonas Usha, and he says, well, we also have learned it in a Tanaic source. Now, the Tanaic source deals with the topic of Edim Zomimim. Edim Zomimim, they're lying witnesses. Without getting into the details, we've discussed it often in the past, but they are lying witnesses that eventually, they, when discovered to be lying, when proven to be Zomimim, when two other witnesses come and say, how can you guys have testified about that when you were with us on that day in a different location? So the lying witnesses are then punished with what they were trying to impose on the defendant. So let us now read the source. we testify that so-and-so divorced his wife and paid her the ksuba. The ksuba payment, the financial obligation that a husband has toward his wife upon their divorce. And the Gemara continues at the top of Pei Tesomet Aleph. Vahare hi tachtov u'mishamashto. And lo and behold, she's still living with him and serving him, so to speak, as a husband, as a wife would with her to her husband. V'nimsu zomimim, and we find them to be lying witnesses. Ein oimrim yishalmu kol ksubasa. We don't say that he, the husband, has to pay the entire ksuba. After all, they were trying to claim that the woman already got her ksuba, which would mean that, like, in reality, if she wasn't divorced, but according to their words, she's already received the ksuba. So they were trying to cause her to lose the ksuba. We don't say that they shall pay out that amount, which would have been, we'll say, the superficial approach to the way we ordinarily punish Eidim Zoymimim. So what do we expect of them? Ela Toivas Hanoas Ksubasa. They pay this fee called Toivas Hanoa. What Ezo Toivas Hanoas Ksubasa? What do you mean by that? Before we go further, a ksuba payment, as we indicated before, is what a husband would pay to his wife in the event that he divorces her or he dies, he predeceases her. She would collect the ksuba. However, if, let us say, she predeceases him, so then he inherits the ksuba, namely the money that he would have paid out naturally he keeps, and the properties that she brought into the marriage he receives. He inherits the ksuba. Part of the ksuba are the properties that we indicated earlier, the nechse melug, that she brought into the marriage. She also brings into the marriage possibly another form of property called nechse tzon barzel. That's a type of property where, as opposed to the nechse melug, the husband not only benefits from the fruits, but he also accepts upon himself the obligation of maintaining their value, their market value, so that in the event that he would divorce her and she would take her properties back with her, if there was any devaluation in the properties, he, the husband, would have to compensate for that. Naturally, if there's any profit in the properties, so he would benefit from that. What we just described were nechse tzon barzel, this value responsibility that the husband accepts, which is not a feature of the nechse melug. We are discussing right now what is toivas hanoas ksubasa, so that is it for sure that a married woman will get her ksuba? Not so if he outlives her. So we speak here about the amount a person would pay to take over her position, namely in the event that the woman would be divorced, instead of the husband paying the woman, she sold her rights, we call them rights or options, to the ksuba. She sold that to an outsider. How much would an outsider pay for that right to take over her position? He's not going to be paying the full value to the woman, because there is a risk feature here. She might die before the husband. In that case, the husband wins the pot, so to speak. The husband inherits and not the person that purchased it. He would lose the money that he had paid her in order to take over her position. So what we just described, we'll call it the ksuba options that a man, an outsider, might buy from a woman. I said a man, it's a genderless issue. Anyone who's a purchaser of the ksuba rights from the married woman, how much would they pay for that? That's called toivas hanoa. So the Gemara continues on the third line from the top. Esu tevas hanoas ksubasa. How do you calculate that? How do you describe that? Oimdim, we estimate kama odom roitzelitein the ksuba shel zu. How much would an outsider pay for the options to collect this woman's ksuba shim, this armelon, is garsha, in the event that she would become a widow, or she would be divorced? Then the outsider would collect the full amount of the ksuba. The mesa, however, the risk factor is that if she dies, Yerushana Baila, the husband would inherit her, and the purchaser would not have any rights to it. So how much would a person pay for that to take over her position? The Rashi at the top, he elaborates on this, and I think we'll benefit if we look at the Rashi together. Varehi tachtov, and we describe these witnesses testifying about a woman having their claim she was divorced and received her ksuba, but she was still married. De'i vaday nizgarsha ayadei edim achirim, if in fact she was really divorced through the testimony of other witnesses, ki mishtikhi hanoch edim zoimimim, when these witnesses are found to be liars, havu mishalmin lo kol ksubasa, they would then have to pay, in fact, the entire ksuba. The habolav sudi kulimina, they were trying to cause her to lose that through their false testimony. The koamri, they were claiming no san lo, he already paid her the ksuba. But that's not the case in our Gemara. Avol hashta shema eino asida lito ksubasa li'olam. In the case of the Gemara, maybe she won't ever receive the ksuba shema tomus v'yirushena baila. Maybe she will predecease the husband, and the husband would inherit her. V'nimtza shelo hayu mafsidin oisa klum. In retrospect, it would then turn out that they weren't trying to cause her to lose anything. She dies before the husband, she wouldn't get the ksuba anyway. Therefore, when you're dealing with false witnesses that testify concerning a woman who's still married, we don't tell them pay her the entire ksuba. Ela undin, we evaluate kama adam roitze litein lo miyad b'ksubasa. How much would a person be willing to pay immediately for her ksuba al hasafik, on the doubt, meaning with this doubt in mind? What's the doubt? And here Rashi describes it: she'im nisarmelo nisgarshi lenahu. If she were to become a widow or be divorced, so the purchaser would get the ksuba in her stead. V'him tomus, if she would die, and in that event the purchaser would lose whatever he had paid her. The false witnesses are to pay the still married woman that they lied about that amount. That amount that the woman potentially could have made on the sale of her ksuba, they were causing her to lose right now with their testimony. If we were to believe them, she wouldn't be able to sell her ksuba because, according to their testimony, she already received it. It's not something that she would be able to sell to others. Rashi adds, Toivas Hano Klomar Dover Muad. Relative to the value of the ksuba, the Toivas Hano value, that risk value that an outsider would pay, is a small amount relative to the entire ksuba value. So now, we've been dealing with a great amount of detail in the last few minutes, not to lose sight of the forest for the trees. What about the issue of Takonas Usha? So now we continue in the Gemara. V'i salka daitoch lesa l'takonas usha. If the concept of takonas usha, or the enactment of takonas usha, doesn't exist, amai yiroshena baila, why does the source say that if she were to die, so then the purchaser would be out of luck, because the husband would inherit her. Tazvin ksubasa legamri. Let her sell her ksuba entirely. Which means part of the ksuba involves the, we mentioned the properties that she brings into the marriage. If the husband has no rights to claim from purchasers items that she brought into the marriage, properties that she brought into the marriage, the husband has no rights to claim from them. So then, couldn't she sell her entire ksuba to an outsider, leaving no risk to those outsiders? Omar Abaye. Abaye responds and says, Im omru benichse maluv, granted that we'll say there is no takona susha, so that we would say that the woman has rights, has control over the nichse maluv. Those are properties that the husband did not assume any responsibility over. All he had were the rights to the fruits, to the production of those fields. So those kind of fields, those kind of properties, the woman could have sold, and the husband would not be able to retrieve them from the purchasers. However, Yomru benichsei tzon barzel, would you say the same thing regarding the tzon barzel type properties? We described them before. Those are properties that the woman brings into the marriage. They're part of her tsuba. They are properties, the tzon barzel, by the way, is an expression that means, literally, is sheep made of iron. Iron is a very hard material that doesn't erode very quickly. It maintains its content, its value in terms of its quantity. So properties that the husband assumes responsibility for, those are properties whose value will be guaranteed, so to speak. Those kind of properties, since the husband assumed market value responsibility over them, that if there's any decrease in their value, he would have to make good on it. He has control over those properties. Those are properties certainly she would not be able to sell. So that those kind of properties, the source can very well describe Yiroshena Baila. In the event that she were to die, the husband, being that he had assumed responsibility over those properties, he would be able to claim them back from any purchasers. Let us take a look at the Rashi. Im omru benichse maluk shetucha lemochron. If you were to say, as we suggested, fine, there's no proof that there exists takonas usha from this source, I could tell you that. And if you try to prove that there is takonas usha from Yerushena Baila, I will tell you not so. Takonas usha spoke about the woman selling the nichse malug and the husband being able to retrieve them. We can live with the idea that the husband would not be able to retrieve them and that the woman could sell the nichse malug. So the Rashi says, Im omru benichse malug shetucha lemochron ve'ein habal moitzi miyad halakuchos. Share im pichasu pichasu law vim hosiru hosiru law. If they would be devalued, she would have to absorb that loss, and if they increase in value, she would benefit from them. Yomru benichse tzon barzel. Would you say the same thing with regard to those kind of properties? Those are, Rashi goes on, b'ksubosa, the nichse tzon barzel that are written into the ksuba, the hainu nedunyo shechnisa lo b'shuma mi beis avia. That's a reference to the property dowry, nedunya is what we would say, the dowry that she brings into the marriage, that properties that which were subject to evaluation, that's a shuma, mibei sovia, that she brought from her father's house, and their value is written into the ksuba, mekablo of choson, the husband accepts upon himself achrayas, a form of responsibility and guarantee of their value. V'impichasu pichasu lo. If they were to decrease in value, he has to compensate. V'mo siru siru lo. If they increase in value, he, the husband, benefits from it. Kidamrinan v'yavomis b'almona l'kayin gadol, as it says in that tractate, Maseches Yavomis, in the perek named Almona l'kayin gadol, nichseit son barzel, nichosim oimdin b'achrayis hamekabel sham kein barzel zeh, Shehu Koshelios Poches. Nifseit Sambazla here, Rashi's are giving you the literal explanation of it, like we said before. V'hosam vaday lo motzi mezavna. Those kinds of properties she certainly cannot sell. So that the term in the source that indicates that the husband would be able to take them away from purchasers, that Roshana bylaw is focused then on the Tzon Barzel properties. But as far as the Nichsei Malug, the truth is she might be able to sell that completely, and the purchaser of her Ksuba rights would not lose out on that. In effect, he's not buying just the rights, he's buying the properties themselves. Those are the Nichsei Malug, but not so with regard to the Nichsei Tzon Barzel. We mentioned, by way of markings, you can see later on the Omid, in the middle, where the next bow tie appears, the Gemara will say, Rav Papa and Rav Huna Rav Yeshua say, that Tanino l'takon asusha. We have a Tanaic source that they claim is a basis for takon asusha, can serve as evidence that takon asusha is rooted in Tanaic sources. It is not my intention to review all of Daf of our previous shir from Daf Pei Ches, but this point of, we'll say, denying Takonas Usha would serve the interests of Rav Yehuda, who was arguing with Rav Yirmiyah Bar Abba in the situation where a married woman, the mother of Rav Shmuel Bar Abba, if you recall, in our previous shir, had assigned her properties to her son, thereby depriving the husband from those properties. Rav Yirmiyah Bar Abba was willing to give the son the advantage, to have him maintain possession of those properties over the husband. Rav Yehuda said, no, that the husband has first rights to it. The position of Rav Yehuda would be strengthened if you say that there exists Takon Asusha. The position of Rav Yirmiyah Bar Abba would be strengthened if we say that there is no Takonas Usha. And again, Takonas Usha would have benefited the husband regarding the Nichsei Malug. So that at the position that says there is no Takonas Usha, as we said, that would help to benefit the approach taken by Yirmiyah Bar Abba back at the we saw at the top of Daf Pei Ches Amid Beis. We turn back to the Gemara, and you'll notice we have a double underline highlighting Abaye, and then a few lines later, Rav Shalman. On the side of our Gemara, under the Mivneh heading, these are Gishos, approaches, Lahazbir, Loma, Edim, Zoymimim, Shel Ksubas, Isha, Chayovin, Lishalem, Haim, Be'emes, Edusan, Hoiso, Amuro, Lahafsin, Hoisha. Was their testimony, in fact, going to cause a loss to the woman? Now I should really emphasize, add one word in our introduction, which says, why is it that the Edim Zomimim have to pay the Tovus Hanah value to the woman? Were they really trying to cause her the loss? Omar Abaye, Tovus Hanah, the issue of the Tovus Hanah payment, the option payment to the woman in order to take over her position in collecting the ksuba, Hayol Ve'osa Liyodon, since it's come our way, since we started discussing it, Neima Bo Milsa, let us say a word about it. Tovus Hanah Li'isha Havya, when we expect the Edim Zomimim, the false witnesses, to pay the Tovus Hanah, they are going to pay it to the woman. If you were to think that they should pay that to the husband, Lemru Law Edim, let the witnesses say, "My afsedinoch ihavis mizavnis lo l'toivas hano baal havis shokil minoch." Abaye is making the point that that money that's paid by the witnesses, by the false witnesses to the woman, the toivas hano, is money that the husband has no rights to. He cannot ask her, "Hand me over that cash." Because if the husband would be able to demand that money from the woman, the witnesses could simply turn to the woman and say, "Why should we pay you the teivas hano when the husband was going to take it from you? You weren't going to be holding on to it anyway." The Gemara answers, "Omar Rav Shalman, Mishum." Rav Shalman says, even if you say like that, even if you take the position that the husband could demand the money from her, there still is a loss to the woman. Because the more money that's in a household, the more benefits the wife has. Mishum de'iko revach besa. There's revach besa, is increased funds that are in the house from which she could ultimately benefit. So the Edim Zomimim, by falsely testifying about the woman having already received her ksuba and she's still married, are in fact causing her that loss. Omar Rava, Hilchasa Toivas Hano Liisha. The money, in fact, is paid to the woman, V'ein Habal Oichel Peros. And we said before that the money is paid to the woman, and the husband does not have rights to that money, which means we don't say that once the woman is paid, she should then buy a piece of land with that money. And the husband would then be entitled to benefit from the fruits of that land. We don't say that. That's what V'ein HaBa'al Oichel Peros. My Taimo, why is that the case? Why is the husband so, excluded from this answer? Pira Takinu Le Rabbonan. The Rabbonan established that a woman who brings properties into the marriage, the husband has a right to benefit from those, from the fruits of those original properties. However, what we're describing in this case is a monetary benefit from the properties in the form of Toivas Hano. That Toivas Hano value itself would be called fruits. And then the purchase of properties with that money and their subsequent fruit production would be called pira de pira, as the Gemara says, lo tokinu le rabbonan. The fruits of the fruits, the residual fruits, are not something that the rabbis entitled the husband to receive. So that it becomes very clear, even without coming on to Rav Shalman's approach of Revach Besa, from Rava's ruling, one can more easily understand why the Edim Zomimim are expected to pay the woman the Toivas Hano. Through Rava's ruling, we understand that the money is paid to the woman, and she keeps that money. There are no expectations on our part that she were to use that money to buy properties to enable the husband to continue benefiting from those fruits. Those fruits, as we said, are termed pira de pira. He also, Rav Papa, Rav Huna, Rav Yoshua, Mibay Rav, when Rav Papa and Rav Huna came from the yeshiva, Amri, they said, Tanina l'takona susha. There's a Tanaic source that confirms the existence of takonas usha. It says, Ho'eved vo'isha pigiyosan ra, our Mishnah. It says that the slave and a woman that have involvement in terms of injuries, either injuring others or absorbing or themselves becoming injured. Their involvement with others is bad for the public. Hachovel behen chayav, one who injures them has to pay. Behem shechov lebachir turim, and they who injured others are exempt. When we speak about the isha, we're speaking about a married woman, and the married woman is described as someone who has nothing in terms of nothing of her own. And we're embarking on a new marking scheme. You'll see on the side of the Gemara under our Mivna, our structural note. This is a ma'akav, an attempt to keep track. Ma'akav livdok im moker zeh. If this source, ho'evet vo'isha, mevusas ala ikaron shel takona susha, is based on the concept of takona susha. If when we see the trapezoid shape, the volcano shape facing upwards, that indicates yesh raya l'takona susha, that there is proof of its existence in Tanaic literature, and the inverted form has it as lo roim mikan l'takona susha, that we don't have evidence. If you were to think that Takonas Usha doesn't exist, and that the woman's properties are hers, and the husband has no first claim on it over outside purchasers, Tazvin Nichse Malug, let the woman sell the Nichse Malug properties that she brought into the marriage, v'titeinle, and pay the nizak, the one, the victim of the one she attacked. Why in the Mishnah does it say that the woman who attacks others are exempt from paying? Here she's got a source of payment, the nichse malug. She can sell those properties, get a good price for them, and pay the nizak whatever is due to him. So from the fact that it says in our Mishnah she doesn't pay, it indicates she doesn't have power over the Nifse Malug, to the extent that if she were to sell them, the husband would be able to take them away from the purchasers. The Gemara responds, Ulitameh, according to you, that you want to say that there is evidence of Takona Susha, Nehi nami diise l'takonas usha v'lo motzi mizavno l'gamri. Granted that there is takonas usha, which would tell us she can't sell the properties in a permanent, complete, total form. Tazvin l'nichse malug b'tevis anah v'titein lei. Why doesn't she sell the nichse malug? Okay, not at their total value, but at the Toivas Hanoa value that we spent so much time describing earlier. It's a value that the woman could be paid in the event that the husband actually divorces her, so that outsider would take over the Nichse Malug. Why not that? Why does the Mishnah indicate that she doesn't pay anything? Even if you say that there is Takona Susha, there still was the Toivas Hanoa factor. So why is that not suggested? Why is that not suggested as a source of money for the woman? Elo Deles Law. She doesn't have any Nichse Malug. Hachinami Deles Law. So too, as far as we are concerned, that there is no Takona Susha. And you'll ask, if there's no Takona Susha, so let the woman sell the Nichse Malug straight out. She doesn't have. So that when it's said in the source, Isha Ptura, it's not a proof that there is, that Takona Susha exists, but it simply shows us that she doesn't have any Nichse Malug. So there's no Toivas Hanoa, and there's no actual Nichse Malug to speak of either. At this point, you notice we have an angular brackets, and they continue quite a while. On the side of the Gemara, by the starred note, we've written Tam l'sograyim Ad Omid Beis, the reason for these brackets that continue way down, Omid Beis, you can see, use your scanning abilities to look ahead to find how far they go, that Ad Kan HaGemora Choshva Lochiach Shamokar Mevuzas Al Ha'ikaron Shel Takana Susha. Up till this point, we thought that the Mokar, the Mishnah, was based on the principle of Takana Susha. V'docha, and then we just rejected it. D'ein Mikan Hoychocha, from here there's no proof of Takana Susha. In other words, the woman's exemption from paying is not an indication that there exists Takana Susha. Achrei hasugrayim, after the brackets, Hagemora mamshicha b'nisayon l'mtsoi bosis kol shehu b'tanoyim l'takon asusha. After this bracketed section, the Gemara will resume trying to find some basis for the takon asusha. B'toch hasugrayim, within the bracketed section, Hagemora roitzi levarer, the Gemara wants to clarify, lomo isha shechov lebacher p'tura mitashlim, why in fact is she exempt from paying. Now that we've mapped out the general structure of the Gemara, we can go through the bracketed section without any need for skipping. We have a topic heading in our margin that reads the Nosei. L'cha'ira, at first glance, yesh efsharus There seems to be options or approaches that would enable a married woman to pay the victim of her aggression. Ayadei mechiras ksubasa b'tovas hanah, through her selling of the ksuba for the tovas hanah value. Granted, in our Gemara, just before the brackets, we said that the source, the Mishnah, doesn't speak about the sale of Nichse Malug, because as far as the Mishnah is concerned, the Mishnah is talking about a case where she doesn't have any Nichse Malug. But the Ksuba has other aspects to it. It has the financial obligations that the husband owes to the woman. In the event that the woman is divorced, the husband would have to pay her money. And we're suggesting, couldn't the woman sell the options to her ksuba, that in the event that she would be divorced, the husband would pay an outsider? So there's a certain option value that still can be spoken about with regard to her ksuba, beyond the issue of the nichse malug that the woman has or doesn't have. Lama katani shehi shechov lebachem tur. Why does the Mishnah say that if she injured others, that she's exempt? Is there not, in fact, a source of money for the woman with which to compensate her victims? On the under the Mivneh heading, the structural note, we have triangles, and you'll see the triangles will appear in alternating directions. This is a ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of the back and forth question answers style of the Gemara. With the point facing up, it will indicate a she'ela, question, loma hi lo mocheres, why doesn't she sell? Why doesn't she sell some and get some money? The inverted triangle, tshuva, responses, hasiba shi lo mocheres, the reason that she doesn't sell. Now, the Gemara. All of this is in light of the Mishnah, our Mishnah from Daf Pei Zayin Amud Aleph, that said, heim shechov lebachirim, turin, that they who injure others, and the emphasis right now is on the married woman, she is exempt from paying. So the Gemara asks, v'tazvin ksubasa b'toyva sanah v'titein lei, why can't she sell her ksuba, and that refers to the monies that she potentially could make in the event that she's divorced. Why couldn't she sell those options That's the Tovas Hanoah to someone. Get cash and then pay the victim of her aggression with that money. The Gemara answers, Ha money, Rabbi Meir he. The Mishnah is in accordance with Rabbi Meir, who has a principle. The Amar Osir lo l'adam shiashe or shiyeshe es ishtoi. It is forbidden for a married man to maintain a wife, afilu shol achas v'lo ksuba, even for an hour, even for a short amount of time, without her having a ksuba. So the thinking right now is that if she sells her ksuba rights to an outsider, so here you have a married woman that no longer has a ksuba. Her rights to the ksuba she sold, and we cannot accept such a situation. The Gemara responds, even taking Rabbi Meir into consideration, that isn't reason enough to stop her from selling the ksuba. The Taimomai, what's the logic behind Rabbi Meir who says that a man cannot have a woman, have a wife without a ksuba? Kedei shelote kala b'einov lo tzia. It is a means of deterring a man from too easily divorcing his wife. Literally, it should not be easy in his eyes to divorce her. How do we deter divorces? How do we impose, we'll say, deterrence or motivations for him not to divorce her? By obligating him to pay out money to her if he does divorce her. Well, forget about to whom the money is paid. The basis is obligating him to pay out money. Hacha lo megarish lo. In this case, that let us say she would have sold her ksuba, the ksuba rights, the options to her ksuba. Even if she did sell those options, he won't readily divorce her. Di megarish lo asu hanoch dezavni. If he does divorce her, those that bought the options to her ksuba will come along. They're going to demand collection of the ksuba from the husband. So there's, once again, no reason for her not to be able to sell it based on Rebbe Meir. So the question comes back. Why does the Mishnah indicate that if the married woman injures others, she's exempt because she has no money? Why should she be described as not having any money? Ella, we answer. Toivas Hano Mili Ninu. Toivas Hano is Mili. Mili literally means words. For our purposes, it would mean something that's abstract. It's an option that you're selling. It's not something tangible. Umili lo mishtabdi. That which we classify as Mili is not something that is bound. So it's true she has the potential to make this money, but we cannot describe it as being bound to the victim of her aggression. So the Nizak doesn't have as a claim against the woman, hey, you know, you owe me your Tovas Hanoah value. The Gemara asks in response, Aloma lo, Mili de Mizavni Bedinri Ninhu. Why do you say not so? It sounds abstract, but it's something abstract that can be sold for money. We answer, Elo Mishum de Shmuel. Why is the Tovas Hanoah sale not an option? Because of Shmuel's teaching. The Omar Shmuel, Hamoichish Tar Choiv Lechaveru V'chozeru Mochaloi Mochol V'afil Yoreish Mochel. Someone who is owed money. He is the owner of a Shtar Chov. He possesses a Shtar Chov, a bill of collection. For our purposes, the Ksuba is a type of bill of collection. She has a Chov, a claim against her husband, a potential claim against her husband. So the Bal Chov, the Malve, in general, the lender of money, or in this case, the woman who has a claim of money, if they sell a Shtar Chov, they sell it to a purchaser. Options on collecting debts. Instead of my collecting the debt, I might sell it to someone else. They'll pay a little less than face value of the debt, but they will be entitled to, they become the owners of the debt. So a Starchov was sold to a purchaser, and then that original lender, the original owner of the debt, It's Choser u'machalo. He turns around and forgives the borrower. In this case, the husband is the one who owed the money. They turn, the original lender or the owner of the debt turns around and is moichel, forgives the obligation. Mochel, it's considered forgiven. And what does that mean then for the one who purchased the option of collecting that debt? It's a loss to them. They thought they were buying a debt, but the debt was canceled. And not only that, Vafilu Yoresh Mochel, even the heir of the Malve has that Mochel, that forgiving power, forgiving the debt. Rashi, the Chazar HaMoicher U'Mochel, Lo Mochel. Rashi, four lines from the bottom, says, Hilkoch Yamrin and Law, if we were to say to the woman, Tazvin, Tizban, sell your rights, sell your ksuba rights to an outsider and get money from that and pay the victim of your aggression. Mafsedinon leila lokeach. We're fearful that really is going to be a cause for the purchaser of the debt to lose out. Tehi hadro mochalalu ksubas labal. She'll turn around and forgive the ksuba claim, the ksuba debt, to the benefit of her husband, Hayol, the Al Korcha he Mochrosa. Since we're forcing her to sell it, so she's not gonna be collecting the ksuba, what some outsider is. So she'll say, you know, forget the whole ksuba debt to the husband, to benefit the husband, and the one who purchased it, the one who is supposedly the source of money for her to be able to pay her victim, he's gonna lose out. But even so, Amri, we can still suggest Zivuni Zovin, let her sell the ksuba b'toivas hanah, the titain lei, and pay that money, or pay a fraction of that money to the victim of her aggression. Ve'i mochlo lei legabi baal, and if she happens to forgive the ksuba debt in favor of her husband, Tim Chalo, so then let it be. But in the meantime, she hasn't forgiven the debt. Is it? Do you claim it's like inevitable? Amri, the Gemara says yes. Kol legabi baal vaday mochalo le. She will certainly forgive the ksuba debt to her husband. Vafsedine lahuzavino biyodayim lo afsedinu. And for us to come in and cause, in a proactive fashion, a loss to the purchaser, that we're not going to do. In other words, we're not going to say to the woman, sell the tovas hanav, the ksuba, to some unfortunate purchaser who's going to end up losing, because we know that she is going to forgive that debt in favor of her husband. V'chitema, maybe you'll suggest, zavina nihale lahu dechov lobei b'tovas hanav. Why doesn't she sell the Tovas Hanah, which is a value, the option value? Let her give the Tovas Hanah to the victim himself of her aggression. Let that be the compensation for her having attacked him. We continue at the top of Omid Beis. Dei mochlo legabi baal lo kol mafsid dehashtonami lo midi kol yohavale. That even in the worst case scenario, that she does forgive the ksuba debt in favor of her husband, the victim of her aggression isn't really losing out. As things are right now, he's not getting anything. So why does the Mishnah say potter? Potter indicating she has no obligation. Let her, as we say, give the Tevas Hanah to the victim of her aggression, and what was our problem before, that she might forgive the debt? So be it. Even if she does forgive the debt, she's not causing him a loss. The Gemara answers soif at the end of the day, though, kol legabi ba vale mochala. When it comes to the husband, she will certainly forgive the debt. Vatruchi beidino bichdi lo matruchinon. And for us, to trouble the court to oversee this transfer of the Tovas Hanoah to the victim. We're not going to bother the court for nothing. For the inevitable forgiving of the debt altogether. We continue. We're now at the fourth line from the top of Omid Beis. Ela ha desanya. We raise a question. It says v'chein hi shechovla bevayla lo hifsida ksubasa. If she attacks her husband, she doesn't lose the ksuba. In other words, she attacked her husband. There's a financial debt that she incurs to her husband. It says here she doesn't lose her ksuba. Am I? Why does the source say that? Taz venino nihale luksubasa lebayla betoivas hano beho chavola. Let her grant the toivas hano of the ksuba to him, to the husband, as payment for her aggression. The mochla legabi baal lekopseda. If she forgives the ksuba debt to her husband, no loss is being suffered. It's not like remember the outside purchaser who bought the tovas hanoah, the options to her ksuba, and then she forgives the debt, so he loses out, that outside purchaser. But here, if she's going to be saying, take the tovas hanoah value in lieu of the injury I imposed onto you, my husband, and then she says, you know what, forget having to pay the ksuba, the husband's not losing out. The Gemara says, ha vadai Rabbi Meir hi. This situation where that is not presented as an option, rather, as the source says, she does not lose out her ksuba, that is certainly in accordance with Rabbi Meir. The Amar Aser liodam shiyisha es ishtoi afilu shoachas belo ksuba. That it's forbidden for a married man to have a wife without a ksuba, v'taimomai. And what was the logic behind that? Kidei shelo tekalo bienov lahotzia. So that it shouldn't be so easy for him to divorce her. Well, hacha megaresh lo vegavi le b'chavlei mina. Here, he will certainly be encouraged or have sufficient, no deterrent to him to divorce her. And collect the ksuba, so to speak, keep the ksuba in exchange for the chavala that he, the injury that he sustained. So that, just to repeat, by following that suggestion of let her transfer the ksuba rights to her husband, that's simply paving the way for him to easily divorce her. The Gemara responds with a question. Even if she doesn't sell it to him, hashtonami megaresh lo, now that in fact he's the victim of her aggression, he'll divorce her. Vegavi le bechavale mina, and once he divorces her, he'll then we'll say he pays her the ksuba, and then he'll collect it as a source of payment for the injury. So even if you don't leave the option of the woman, the wife, transferring the ksuba rights to her husband, you're not deterring him from divorcing her. He's going to divorce her anyway in order for him to be able to have a source of collection for the injury. The Gemara says, that's not so. Because the kagon, the nofish ksubosa, we're describing a situation where we said above she doesn't lose the ksuba. The ksuba that she has coming to her is very expensive, very large value to it. The mishumahu purta, for that small amount, that relatively speaking, that would be compensation for his injury, lo mafsid tuvo, he's not going to lose out a lot. So if his injury, just to use our arbitrary numbers, if his injury was $100 of injury, and the woman's ksuba that he would have to pay her in the event of divorce is $1,000, he's not going to lose out $900 to end up paying out the $1,000 in order just to get $100 back. The Gemara says, well, ve'id nefisha ksubasa miksuba daraisa. If her ksuba is in fact worth more than the basic ksuba. Ksuba daraisa would mean the Torah amount provided for her ksuba. There's a discussion in Maseches Ksubas whether ksuba is daraisa or darabonan, but we'll refer to this as the basic amount for her ksuba. If her ksuba, this married woman's ksuba, has greater value, because when they initially got married, he dedicated much more to her marriage than the basic amount that he's obligated to. So that if you have a case like that, that her ksuba is more than the ksuba doraisa, nukmo aksuba doraisa, let us say that the woman will be guaranteed her basic ksuba because of Rebbe Meir's concern. She shouldn't be easy for him to divorce her. The idach and the amount beyond that, tizvana tizavna nihale bechavle, let her sell that additional amount to her husband in exchange for the debt that she owes to him for having injured him. Why does it say above she doesn't lose out the ksuba? The Gemara answers, Kagon, the source above that said she doesn't lose out the ksuba, Kagon delo nefisha ksubasa miksuba daraisa. She doesn't have a large, an inflated ksuba, worth more than the basic amount. Dehave chavle arbazuzi. The situation above in the source is the injury that she owes him is worth 4 zuz. Demishum arba zuzi, for the 4 zuz that he would be entitled to receive from her, lo mafsid esrim v'chamisha. Esrim v'chamisha literally is 25. It's 25 sloim, a type of coin that is worth 100 zuz. 100 zuz is the basic amount owed to a woman. Let us say she married him as an almon, as a widow, so that the source above, where we say lo hifsida ksubasa, is describing a scenario where the injury that she imposed upon him was worth much less than the basic ksuba, the ksuba doraisa, so that he's not going to actually divorce her in order to end up receiving a mere 4 zuz while having to pay out 96. Question. Eloha de Sanya. The following Tanaic source that says, Kishem shelo timkor vihi tachtov, kach lo tafsid vihi tachtov. Just like she doesn't sell her ksuba while she's married, she also doesn't lose. In other words, she never loses while she's still married. Why does the source say so emphatically, in an unqualified fashion, she never loses out? There are occasions, scenarios, where she could lose. And what would that be? Where, in fact, her ksuba is worth more than the ksuba doraisa. And as we said before, in a case like that, so we would say she should sell to the husband the rights to the amount of the ksuba beyond the ksuba doraisa, and in that event she will be losing out on the ksuba that she was given when she got married. Omar Rava Seifa, the Tanaic source, which was the end of the Braisa, which represented the end of the Braisa, that section, Asa'an L'Ksubas Bonin Dikrin, is referring to an entirely different topic. It's referring to the issue of Ksubas Bonin Dikrin. Now, Ksubas Bonin Dikrin requires a fair amount of background in order to appreciate. And there's no better way than going through the Rashi, who provides all of the necessary background for appreciating what we mean here when we say she doesn't lose out the ksuba. So let's learn Rashi together in the upper part of the narrow lines. Ksubas one and dikrin, the perek narrow shin is patito. In the fourth parak of Maseches Ksubas, Bonin Dikrin Dihavi Lichi Minoi, a woman that marries a man, the man says to her upon their marriage, he says the male children, Bonin Dikrin, the male children that you have with me, bear in mind that a man might have children from another marriage. So he addresses this particular woman that he's marrying with the following. The children that you have with me, Inan, Yahavion, Yarsin Kesik Subosech, Yesra Chukeen, Dimachuan. They will inherit the value of your ksuba, bearing in mind, as we've been mentioning several times today, that the woman's ksuba not only is a reflection of the money that the husband guarantees to his wife, but it also contains properties that she brings into the marriage from her father's home. A man, when marrying off his daughter, will be encouraged to give her more and more if he were to know that his hard-earned properties would eventually end up in her children's possession and not divided out as part of an inheritance to children from another woman that the son-in-law may have. So the husband, when marrying the wife, he gives her this guarantee, this comfort. Truth is that it's ksubas banan dikrin is a rabbinic enactment that the children from this specific woman will be entitled to inherit her ksuba, which is an inheritance beyond the husband's own properties that in fact will be divided equally amongst all of his children. So the husband says, upon their marriage, the children that we have together, that we call your children, will inherit your ksuba as a portion beyond their portion that they receive as part of the general inheritance. Hayu lo shtei noshim. Imagine a man has two wives. We have a little illustration of this on the side, maybe to keep things simple or keep things clear, not to get too confused. So we have a man that has two wives. Uksubas lachas gedoylo mishel chaverta, and the ksuba value of one is more than the other. Umesu shtein bechayov. And the two women die in the husband's lifetime. Fiyorshan, and the husband inherits his wives. O achas bechayov, viyorsha. Or you can have a situation where one of the women dies in his lifetime, and the husband inherits her. Afal pikein, lo botlok subotza eitzoboneha. Im Yeshla ben Zacharimenu. Her ksuba, even though the husband inherited it, don't think that it becomes absorbed into his own properties and loses their identity as being her ksuba, her ksuba value. Ukshiboyin lachloik bonov binechosov achar moisoi. When this man's sons come to divide his estate after his death, Neitlin Eluk Subas Imon vi Eluk Subas Imon, the two sets of sons will each one inherit their own mother's ksuba respectively. Those amounts are not going to be divided equally amongst all of the sons. Vashar, properties that the husband had other properties that the husband had, independent of things that his wives brought into the marriage, chalkin b'shaveh. Those are divided out equally amongst all of the sons. V'ein yecholim b'nei ha-kayemes loymar. And we now explain how Ksubas Bonin Dikrin becomes manifest, how you really see it. The sons of the woman that lived beyond the husband, where the husband predeceased her, one of the two wives, they cannot say Loimar, they cannot say the following: Anu Nito Ksubas Imenu. We are going to collect our mother's ksuba. Apparently she died in the meantime. And the husband's estate hadn't paid her. So they're going to say that the ksuba money that was owed to our mother, we're going to collect her ksuba. She kebalas choif, because she's like a regular creditor. In that sense, it was money that was literally owed to her. V'atem, but you guys, you, the sons of the first wife, the wife that died in father's lifetime, in our father's lifetime, in other words, her husband's lifetime, you guys, you sons, al titlu, you have no rights to your mother's ksuba, she'ein limchem ksuba, sherei bai lo yorsha, your mother doesn't have a right to the ksuba, her husband inherited her, she predeceased him. Whereas all of this is what they cannot say. V'kaimalon hasam dehamoicheres ksubosa liachir b'toyvesano. And we hold as follows, that a woman who sold her ksuba to an outsider in exchange for the option value, so the woman received money from some outsider, umeisa b'chaye b'ayla, and that woman happened to predecease her husband, Fiyorsha, and the husband inherited her. Mafsid halokeach, that fellow who purchased the options to her ksuba loses out. Afal piking, lo hifsidu boneo ksubas bonin dikrin. What we're reading now is the explanation of the Tanaic source that said lo tafsid. What lo tafsid? Her sons will not lose the rights, their unique rights to their mother's ksuba, they don't lose out on those rights. V'lo yomru b'nei chaverta, in a case where the mother of the, we'll say the first wife's, where the first wife had sold her ksuba rights, that does not enable the sons of the second woman to say, imchem poshaba, your mother, she was irresponsible, she was lightheaded with regard to her ksuba, she also kayemes, had she outlived the husband, lohoisa gaiva, she wouldn't have collected, sharei lukuchos hayu gaivin osada, ones who purchased the options would be collecting her ksuba. So that this thinking might have led the sons of the second wife to say to the sons of the first woman who sold the options to lose out entirely, with the claim that had their mother outlived the husband, the woman wouldn't have collected anything. Why can't this claim be made? Mishum di amri lahu, because the sons of the first woman, the woman who had sold the ksuba for Toivus Hanoh value, they say, Zuzi Ansua, she was hard pressed for money, she needed money in an urgent fashion, so she had to, she was forced to sell the options. Velolav Sidinu Niskavna, her intent wasn't to cause us to lose out the eventual rights to collect the ksuba. Of course, in the event that that our mother predeceased our father, the husband. So with that in mind, the Tanaic source said, lo tafsid. And that's what Rava is answering, seifa asan l'ksubas bonen dikren. the Hachi Katani, and the source is to be understood as follows. Kishem Shahamacheris Ksubasa Lachirim. Just like in a case where a woman might have sold, would have sold the option rights to the Ksuba to outsiders, and she dies before the husband. Lo hipsida Ksubas Banindikrin. There is no loss to her sons in inheriting eventually that woman's Ksuba. And why? Here the Gemara interrupts with its explanation. That's why we have little brackets here. My time, Azuzi Huansua. The woman in selling her ksuba, the Toivas Hanoa value to some outsider, was not an act of her trying to cause a loss to her sons, but it was because she was hard pressed for money. Kach Moicheres Ksubasa Labaila. So too, in the event that she were to sell the ksuba rights to her own husband, lo hifsida ksubas bonin dikrin, she would not lose out, or her children would not lose out on the right to ultimately inherit that ksuba. My taima, zuzi hudan sua. She sold the ksuba rights to her husband because she needed cash, and she was hard pressed for cash, but she had no intention in causing any loss, to ultimate loss to her sons in the eventual inheritance as we described. We continue with a question. We have this marked as a long question, and we've also used a dashed bow tie. The bow tie is a continuation of the bow tie markings that we already saw on the previous Omid on Daf Pei Tesamid Aleph, and we saw initially on Pei Chesamid Beis, where we started today's shir, attempts to show that the Ksubas Bonin Dikrin has a Tanaic roots. The reason we used a dashed bow tie is simply because here we're presenting it, although in a Tanaic form, but in a Tanaic controversy. So our hope is that by using this marking, you're able to connect the general point here, the point here back to the general scheme of things, where Takanas Usha can be found to have some type of Tanaic basis. The Gemara, though, afterwards will say that the explanation of the following two sources isn't necessarily because Takanas Usha is their Machlokas Tanayim. And that you'll see how it unfolds. Before we go further in the Gemara, we glance at the side where we have the Nosei Mivne heading. As far as the dashed bow tie, Tam Lakivkuv, Kan, Bo HaGemara, L'Kasher Takanas Usha, L'Mokur B'Tanoim. Here the Gemara is trying to connect the Takanas Usha to a Tanaic source. Avo Mitzad Sheni Omeres Shehi Shnuya B'Machlekes. On the other hand, we're trying to show that it's a really controversial. It's not something where there's unanimous agreement to its existence. Let's first read the Gemara, and then we'll continue with our structural presentation. Lema takonas usha tanoi hi. Can it be said that takonas usha is a machlokas tanoyim? The Toni Chada, one source, says, Avde malug yoitzin b'shein v'ayin li'isha avalo li'ish. V'tanya idach loy li'ish v'lo li'isha. The translation or the concept of Yoitzin B'Shein V'Ayin is a principle that applies to the owner of a heathen slave that injures, that knocks out his slave's tooth or eye. The Torah says that in the event that one of these limbs, there are actually 24 Roshei Evarim, but we'll limit it to the tooth or eye for right now, when the master knocks out one of these limbs, the slave goes free. If some outsider injures someone's slave, obviously the slave isn't going to go free. But if the owner does so, so the slave goes free. This source describes a woman that brought into the marriage slaves. Her father gave to her slaves that will enable the husband to benefit from their production. They're called malug. But the principle is something that the woman maintains. She owns the principle. The work value, the production, their output, the husband benefits from. The first source said that the Avnei Malug Yoytzin B'Shein Vayim Le'isha Avalo Le'ish. If the woman were to knock out their Shein Vayim, tooth or eye, they will go free. But not if the husband were to do so. Well, that shows that the woman is the owner of the slaves. The husband is like an outsider. V'tanya idach, another source says, lo leish v'lo leisha. Neither one, if they knock out the slaves, shein v'ayin, will result in the slave going free. So we have two sources that we've labeled aleph and beis. Savrua, there is an assumption that we're working with right now. The Kuli Alma that everyone holds. And we're mentioning now this assumption that everyone holds will be as an assumption the Gemara will maintain until we get to stage 4 or presentation number 4 of the upcoming Gemara. Everyone holds up till that point that Kinyan Peros, the production value that the husband has in these slaves, Lav kikinyan aguf domi, is not the equivalent, is not tantamount to possession of the principal of the slave, principal value of the slaves. So that we acknowledge that the husband has a kinyan peros, but it will say it's insignificant as far as true ownership is concerned. So making that assumption, my lav, beha komiflagi. Is it not then so that the point of difference between these two sources is the following? The man diomar leisha, the one that says that if the woman knocks out the shein v'ayin, the slave will go free, that indicates that she is the total owner. She's the total owner, and the husband is quite irrelevant. In terms of ownership points, less late takonas usha. This first source denies the existence of takonas usha. Umadomar lo leish v'lo leisha, the one that says that the slave will not go free, not if the husband knocks out those limbs, and not even if the woman knocks out those limbs. So that if the wife knocks out those limbs, the slave isn't going to go free. Why not? Is lay takonas usha, because he holds from takonas usha. What does that mean? That the husband has a very strong claim on the nichsei malug, here the avdei malug. He has a very strong claim. Based on what does the husband have a very strong claim? Well, like we said before, that if the woman, let us say, were to sell her nichsei malug to some outsider, then she dies, the husband will retrieve that from the purchasers. So, as a result of that, according to source Bayes, even if the wife, the woman who brought these slaves into the marriage, knocks out the limbs, the slaves are not going to go free. Let us take a look at the Rashi. There's a Rashi right across from here. You see there's a double star. And it reads as follows. Deman de Omar lo le'ish v'lo le'isha. That source, that was called source Beis in our Gemara. De is le takonas usha. He is a Tanaic source that subscribes, that accepts the existence of such an enactment called takonas usha. Hilkoch, Mishum, Ish, Lo Nafki, As far as the husband knocking out those limbs, the slave is not going to go free. De lo koni lehem legufayu mamish. He doesn't have a. He only has a kinyan pairs. He doesn't own their essence, their bodies themselves. He doesn't own their principal value. Mishumisha nami lo nafki. And as far as the woman is concerned, the wife, they're not going to go free if she impacts them. The olim shibude lemeve kikinyan aguf. His claim on them is, only means strong, has a strong lean upon them to make it such that it's as if he has a Kenyan goof. Even though we said Kenyan Peros is Lavka Kenyan goof, so from the Kenyan Peros aspect, from the fact that he benefits from their production, that doesn't grant him the Kenyan goof. But the power that he has in collecting those slaves, if she were to have sold them, and he, the husband, collect them from those purchasers, that gives him power. That empowers him to make it as if he is the owner of those slaves, to the extent that the woman becomes subsidiary, and if she were to knock out those limbs, she's not really the owner, and hence they won't go free. Let's turn back to the Gemara. Actually, before we do so, we want to continue with our structural analysis. We encountered a diamond, which we called number one. On the side, we read where the diamond is featured. These are attempts lahasbir shnei brisos, the two Tanaic sources, be'inyan yitzias eved l'cheirus ayadei shein v'ayin. The two brisos that describe the slave going free. Matris Agamora Levarer Ma Emdas Hatanoim Legabi Takonas Usha. The initial point of the Gemara is to figure out what's the position of the Tanoim regarding the Takonas Usha. Imze Machlokes Tanoim. Is it a Machlokes Tanoim? That was suggested at stage one, and that we've learned already. Oy the Kuli Alma Maskimin Letzad Echad, or possibly both Tanaic sources agree to one position on that score regarding the existence of Takana Zusha. The house marking that you see is Havlotas Gishay Safuchos, highlighting opposite approaches. So here we are, back in the Gemara. What have we accomplished in the last few lines? We presented a possibility that Takana Zusha is a Machlokas Tanoyim, is a Tanaic disagreement. As the Gemara goes on, the Gemara says, "Lo, de kule alma islu takona susha." Do you notice the house marking that everyone is in agreement at this point that there is takona susha? If you scan ahead to the upper part of Daf Tzadi Omet Aleph, you see an inverted house. There it says, "De kule alma less lehu lahani tanoi takona susha." The opposite approach, but we're not there yet. So at this point, we say that really all Tanoim, all of these Tanoim, is lehu takona susha. They hold from takona susha. Now, if you say that, when you look back at the sources, we can understand why the slave is not going to go free, even if the woman impacts him. What about source Aleph, the first source, where it says that the slave will go free if the woman impacts him? How do we explain that? If everyone holds from Takona Zusha, that would seem to empower the husband, leaving the woman as not a true full owner of it. Ela, kan kodem Takona, kan the achar Takona. The lettering that we have reflects the lettering of the sources. Source Aleph above was before Takona Zusha was introduced. Well, if that be the case, then the all that we know then is that the husband has Kinyan Peros, which is not Kinyan Aguf. Who has the Kinyan Aguf? Who has the essential ownership of the slaves? The wife, the woman alone, she's the real owner. There's no Takona Zusha empowering the husband. That's because it was before the Takona was made. It's a Tanaic source reflecting an early time in halachic development. And Kan Liachar Takona, source base, that says that even if the woman impacts the slave, causing loss of shein or ayin, it does not go free, because the takana at that point in history had been established already. The Iboyasema, another approach. Idi v'idi la'achar takana v'is lehu takana zusha. Both sources are after the takana was established. And they both hold from takana zusha. If that's the case, so then what about source Aleph, where if the woman impacts the slave, it will go free? What about the and it says that not leash, the husband won't result in the husband's injuring the slave will not result in its going free. Why not? If you're saying that we're at a point of time after takana zusha has been established, then why is the woman presented in source Aleph as being on a higher footing? That source Aleph, what is the explanation behind it? Answer. Kidarova. The Omar Rava, based on Rava's teaching. This teaching appears in numerous masechtas. He says as follows. Hekdish, Chometz, v'shichur. There are three different areas of halacha. Hekdish means someone sanctifies an item. Chometz is the arrival of Pesach, where bread, for example, becomes prohibited. And shichur, which is really of relevance to us, the setting free of a slave, mafkien midei shiabud, it undoes, it voids liens. So in what's the relevance to our discussion? In the event that the husband were to knock out a shein or ayin, that results, that's in the realm of shichur. That undoes his shiabud. It undoes his lien, his control over the eved. The classic case of hafkoa midei shibud involves a lender, a creditor who extended a loan, and in exchange for the loan he was guaranteed payment from either an animal, in the case of Hekdish, someone sanctified an animal. That animal was previously an animal that the lender had a claim on, had a shibud on it. If the owner of the animal, the borrower, sanctifies the animal as a sacrifice to the altar, the lender cannot collect from that animal the debt that he thought he was originally able to. With regard to chometz, a Gentile who had extended a loan to a Jew, and the Jew guaranteed payment of the loan from the chometz. When Pesach comes, that chometz is declared prohibited, so that the loan cannot be paid anymore from that chometz. And most importantly, shichur, if a person borrowed money and established his slave as a means of payment, a source of collection of debt, and then the owner of the slave, before paying up the debt, freed the slave, the lender will not be able to collect from that slave. He'll have to find some other source of collection, but not from that slave. What we just described is shichur being mafkia midei shibud. We read source Aleph that said that if there were avdei malug, a woman brought into her marriage servants, heathen slaves that she owned, if she knocks out the limb, so the slave goes free. If the husband knocks out the limb, the slave will not go free. It is true that as a result of takona zusha, we thought that the husband has a very strong claim or sense of ownership over the slave. But comes along shikhur, the freeing of the slave, and one form of the freeing of the slave is the knocking out of the slave's shein or ayin, that undoes his shibud, his claim to the slave. So he loses his title of ownership, so to speak, over the slave. So he's like an outsider. Well, an outsider that knocks out the limb of someone else's slave, that doesn't result in the slave doesn't go free. Let's continue in the Gemara. Lema de Rava Tanoihi. Shall we say that Rava's teaching, amongst other things, that Shichur is Mafkia Midei Shibud, is actually a Machlokas Tanoim, that only Tana Aleph, the first Tanaic source, would hold from that. But Tanaic source base, where it says that if the slave doesn't go free, Loli Ish for Loli Isha, doesn't subscribe to Rava's approach. In explaining source Aleph as being the one to subscribe to Rava, what did it say in source Aleph? That if the wife knocks out the Shein Rayin, it will go free, not by the husband. And why not by the husband? Because he lost his ownership claims, and because the shichur was mafkia the shibud, voided his claim to the slave as his own, and at that point it becomes exclusively the wife's, and therefore if she knocks out Shevan, she's the exclusive owner, and the slave goes free. The Gemara is proposing here at the second line from the top of Daf Tzadi Yomid Aleph that Rava's teaching then is really a machlokes tanoim, and it conforms only to the first source. The Gemara says, "Lo, the kuli alma islu the Rava." Everyone agrees with Rava's principle that shichur is mafkia midei shibud, and as we said before, that has broad application to all kinds of loans that. Whose payment was guaranteed through the receipt of a particular item, in this case through the receipt of the slave. And if the slave owner who borrowed money were to free the slave in conventional under regular circumstances, the lender would not be able to collect. Everyone agrees with that in principle. But Hacha here regarding the Tanaic sources, particularly the focus right now on source base, the second source. The reason that we don't say that the wife becomes the exclusive owner and the husband thereby losing all ownership of the Eved, all shibud to the Eved, because almuha rabbonan lishibuda debal. The rabbis increased the shibud of a husband. As far as the shibud, the lien that lenders of money have on things, that the shichur would void their shibud, their claim. However, in the case of a husband-wife situation, the rabbis upgraded his shibud, his powers as lien powers. And therefore, we don't say that the wife is the exclusive owner. Now, it's my thinking right now that even though the rabbis increased the husband's powers, claims, not to the extent, though, that he becomes the owner of the slave, as is witnessed by the fact that in source Bays, the slave does not go free through Shein Vayin of when the husband knocks out the limb. If he were truly the owner, then the slave would have gone free. However, the contrast between source Aleph and Beis is that in source Aleph, we don't say that the husband's shibud is upgraded. Therefore, the shichur has total effect, and therefore the slave will not go free because we're talking after Takana Susha, and he's like the owner, but even though he's like the owner, but the shichrur was mafkia, voided his ownership, and it voided his ownership, so he's not considered owner of it, therefore it doesn't go free Shein Vayin. In source base, the Rabbanan, in source base holds that the husband's shibud claim to the slave is has an increased claim to the slave, so that when he question of ownership comes up, it's not as if the woman is the exclusive owner. But I emphasize, even though we're upgrading his ownership, his claim to the slave, it's not upgraded so much to the extent that that his knocking out of the limb would be like the knocking out of a limb done by an owner. The kule almo less luhu lahani tanoi takona susha. Another approach suggests that the tanoim that we've noted, aleph and beis, do not hold from takonas usha. Just parenthetically, I want to mention that in the shita mekubetzes, there's a totally different girsa over here, but for our purposes, we're going to stick with our text. That both Tanoim do not hold from Takonas Usha. V'hocha bekinyan peros kekinyan haguf domi komifliki. And the point of controversy between these two sources is how shall we view the kinyan peros that the husband has. And I think we mentioned earlier that this is in contrast with the approach taken at stage number 2, where we said everyone does hold from Takonas Usha. Another structural note that I don't think we mentioned earlier, but is worthy of highlighting, up till this point, you'll notice we have a crown shape. This crown shape appeared the lower part of Pei Tes Omid Beis, the previous Omid, where we said the Kuli Almo, everyone, the two sources were in agreement that Kinyan Peros Lavke Kinyan Aguf Domi, that the usufruct rights that the husband had in these slaves did not make it as if he were the owner, that he had a holding in the actual Eved. That was an assumption, and that's why the Gemara there introduced it with the word savrua, which is a term indicating an initial way of thinking, but not something that will necessarily remain at the end. And we're seeing that right now. You can see we've applied the crown shape around komiflegi, meaning that that very point of kinyan peres ki kinyan aguf is the source of disagreement between the two sources. Now, how do we take that information and explain the two sources? Well, the husband has a kinyan peros. Does that make it as if he's the owner of it? In describing ownership, that has a direct bearing on will the slave go free through the Shein V'ayin that he knocks out. So, in source Aleph, the husband is described, we're saying, as having, we know that he has a Kinyan Peros, but he's not viewed as the owner. As you can see, the slave goes free only because of the wife knocking out the Shein V'ayin, not the husband's, so that he has a Kinyan Peros, but it's not tantamount to Kinyan Aguf. The second source that puts the two on the same level, the wife and the husband, so there we see that the husband's kinyan peros puts him on the same level as the wife. I just want to say, once again, like we said before, granted that it creates an impression as if he's the owner, but not to the extent that as a result of his knocking out the limbs, will the slave go free. Ubeplukto dehani tanoi. The issue of kinyan peres ke kinyan aguf is found in the following machlokes tanoim. Before we go on with the Gemara, we glance at psukim in the Chumash. Shmois Perek Chof Aleph, first Pasuk Chof, and then Pasuk Chof Aleph. It says in Pasuk Chof, V'chiyaki ishes avdoi oyas amosoi bashevet umeis tachas yodo. If a man who owns a manservant or a heathen bondmaid, he smites them with a staff, and they die. No kom yino came. The owner is subject to court prosecution and a death penalty. Ach im yoyim yoyimayim yamoid. If, however, they don't die immediately, they continue living a day or two. Lo yukam ki kaspahu. Then the owner, and this is a specific leniency granted to the owner of heathen slaves, they will not. The owner will not be subject to court execution. Ki kaspohu, it's his property. If the same were to happen in the case of an outsider that smites the slave, and he dies a while later after as a result of that initial injury, so the outsider who injured the slave and slave dying as a result thereof, that outsider is subject to court execution. The idea of murder isn't limited to instant murder, but a person is held guilty on the charge of murder even if the victim died a little while later as a result of that attack, that injury. So this halacha we call yoyim yomayim, day or two, is a special leniency granted to the owner, the real owner of a slave. We turn now to the Gemara, which is telling us that kinyan peres ki kinyan aguf is a Tanaic disagreement, is found in the following source. We have a frame, but I want you to note ahead of time that in the course of this particular frame, there are points at which it appears that the Gemara interrupts with its own added explanation. We've used a double underline to highlight the point in the source at which you find the issue of kinyan peros ki kinyan aguf coming to the fore. There happens to be several opinions in the source. There's Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Huda. Those are the names that we're interested initially. Later we'll see Rabbi Yossi and then Rabbi Eliezer, who have their comments to make on this particular teaching of Yom HaYomayim as it appears in the source. Before we continue in the text, I just want to note that we have a long marking which ends essentially in the middle of the source, because up till that point we are showing that kinyan peres ki kinyan aguf is a machlokas anoyim. The Gemara. Hamoicher avdoi liacher. A person sold his heathen slave to a second party. Uposak imo, and made an arrangement with the purchaser al menas she yishamshenu shloishim yoim, that the slave that I'm selling will remain in my service for 30 days. Rabbi Meir Oimer, Rishon Yeshno Bedin Yoim Oyomayim, Mitneishu Tachtov. The original owner, during this 30-day period, has the benefit of the leniency of Yoim Oyomayim because the slave is in his domain, is in the original owner's domain during those 30 days. What level of ownership does that initial owner, the seller, have during those 30 days. He has a kinyan peros. He has the continued benefit of the production of the eved, kosovar. So Rebbe Meir is of the opinion, kinyan peros, kikinyan haguf domi. The kinyan peros that the original owner, the first one, has is considered the total ownership, and it's therefore not considered the second person's slave. So who benefits from the leniency of Yom Yomayim as the owner? The first guy. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Sheini Yeshno B'din Yom Yomayim, B'nei Shu Kaspoi. The second fellow, the purchaser, he has the leniency of Yom Yomayim even during those first 30 days. Why? Because he bought the slave. It's his possession. It's his property. Kaspo. It's his, literally, his money. It's his property. Ah, but during those first 30 days, he doesn't have kinyan peros on it. The first guy has the kinyan peros. Kosovar, kinyan peros, the kinyan peros that the first man has, lav kinyan aguf domi, that's not considered ownership of the actual slave. So who's the actual owner? The second guy. So that if he impacts the slave and he dies 2-3 days after the impact, the second guy will not be held as having committed a capital offense. However, the fellow who purchased him would be considered guilty of a capital offense. He's not the owner. He doesn't have that benefit. Rabbi Yossi Omer. Now, before we go on, I just want to make it clear that we presented Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda as being the Tanoim that argue over how to look at Kinyan Peros. We continue. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Shnehem Yeshnon Bedin Yom Yomayim. Both of these fellows, first guy and second guy, have the benefit of the leniency of Yom Yomayim. Zeh Mitnei Shu Tachtov, Vezeh Mitnei Shu Kaspoi. The first fellow has the benefit because the slave is in his possession, it's in his domain. And the second one, because he bought it. Misafkale, Rabbi Yossi represents an opinion that is in doubt. Kinyan peros, e kikinyan aguf domi, e lav kikinyan aguf domi. The suffik nefashis lahakel. Is kinyan peros that the first one has considered kinyan aguf? Well, if it is, then the first guy's the owner, and he'll have that leniency of Yom Yomayim. If Kinyan Peros that the first one has is not Kinyan Aguf, so who's the owner? The second guy is. So he would have the benefit of that leniency of Yom Yomayim. Sofek Nefoshes Lahokyo means when you have a doubt concerning a capital case, are we going to execute the offender? Well, we take the lenient approach and say that if the slave doesn't die immediately, the offender will not be subject to the death penalty. That is, once again, as a result of Rabbi Yossi's doubt as whether Kinyan Peros is Kinyan Guf. We don't know. We can't establish who the actual owner is. And therefore, both this one or that one might be the real owner. And we have to take the position of leniency and not subject either one of these owners to the death penalty. Sofek nefoshos lahakel. Lahakel means going to be lenient. Rabbi Lezer Omer, Shnehem Einon Bedin Yom Yomayim. Rabbi Lezer takes an opposite, extreme approach of stringency. Neither one of these fellows, not the original owner nor the purchaser, have the status of ownership. Zeh Lefish Eino Tachtov. The second guy is not considered an owner because he's not in his, during those first 30 days, he's not in the second fellow's domain. The first one is not considered the owner, hence not to benefit from the leniency because it's not his money. So they're both viewed as outsiders. And Rabbi Lezer is coming to this position from a point of, obviously, from a point of certainty. There's no suffix in Rabbi Lezer's mind. Therefore, there's no basis of applying the leniency of Yom Yomayim. Omar Rava, my time, the Rebbe Eliezer. What is the basis of Rebbe Eliezer's stringency, which, as we just said, reflects a position of certainty. Omar Kro, the Pasuk said, the Pasuk we read before, which spoke about the leniency, that it said, Ki kaspohu, the leniency is because it's his. It's the owner's money. It's the owner's possession. When do we describe a slave as that? Kaspo hamayuchodlo, when it's exclusive ownership. The first guy doesn't have that, so he's an outsider. First guy has only, Kenyan Peros has only use benefit for these initial 30 days. Second guy, it's not exclusively his. He doesn't have use benefit from him, so it's not exclusively his either. They're both viewed as outsiders. As we go on in the Gemara, we have a triangle marking, and on the side under the Mivneh, the structural note, we highlight the word Keman, in a few lines the word Man, Keman Azla. The first triangle introduces the issue of like whom does the following go. These are Shtei She'elos Shel Mi Moker Hadvorim. The common theme in these two questions is who is the author of the following points. In both cases, you'll see. So, even though I'm spoiling the end of the story, but in both cases, you'll see that it turns out to be Rebbe Eliezer, the Tana that we were just dealing with at the end of our Tanaic source. Let's continue now with the Gemara. Keman Azla Haldomar Meimar. Amemar said the following. We want to know, based on whom is Amemar's statement? Ish v'isha shemochru v'nifse malug. Lo osu v'lo klum. We have a married couple. Woman brought properties into the marriage that were not there, whose value was not written into the ksuba, so the husband is not guaranteeing their value, but he has a right to the fruit, the produce of the fields, of the properties that the woman brought in. Imagine this couple together sell those properties to an outsider. Even if they try to sell the property together, lo osiv lo klum means there's no sale. Neither one has the power to sell. Keman, based on whom would that comment of Amemar be? Kerebi Eliezer. That would be in accordance with Rebbe Eliezer. Let's take a look at Rashi. Lo osu v'lo klum, at the lower part of the narrow lines. She'enoi loy lozeh v'lo lozeh. The husband, all he has is a kinyan peros. The wife, all she has is a kinyan aguf. Neither one has full ownership. V'meis echod mehem, if one of them dies, the husband or the wife, ze hanishar motzi miyada lukuchos, the one who survives can retrieve the property from the purchaser. V'lo domo lishutfin de'almo, this isn't like a case of standard partners who have joint ownership of property that certainly can sell their jointly owned land to outsiders. Da'asim yesh loze chelik b'kula lito chatzi v'yesh loze. In a case of standard partners, each partner has a 50% holding of the entire field, the entire property. 50% of the entire property is this one's, and the other 50% is the other one's. Avol acha, but in the case of husband and wife, it's not like that. Kulan kenuyin la leguf. The woman has exclusive ownership of the principal value. For kulan kenuyin lo leperos, the husband has exclusive ownership of the fruits. For leka miyuchad lo lozeh v'lo lozeh, and you don't have this element of exclusively one over the other. Exclusive in the sense, exclusive ownership of guf and peros, you don't have, not by this one nor by not by the husband nor by the wife. Who spoke in those terms of having exclusive ownership in order to establish ownership? That was the approach of Rebbe Eliezer. Let's continue in the Gemara. Man Tana Lahoda Tana Rabbonan. Who would be the author of the following? Mi Shechetzya Eved V'Chetzya Ben Chorin. an individual who is half slave and half free. V'chein eved shel shnei shutfin, and likewise a slave owned by two partners. Ein yoytzin v'roshe evorim shein on chayzrin. The din of shein v'ayin will not be applicable. Shein v'ayin, we mentioned before, if the owner knocks out one of the limbs, so the slave goes free. In this case, where the slave is jointly owned, or just half slave, the halacha of shein v'ayin doesn't apply. Omar le Rav Mordechai the Ravashi, Hochi Amri Mishmei the Rava. The following is said, Rav Mordechai informs Ravashi, the following is said in the name of Rava, Rebbe Eliezer he. This source is in accordance with the opinion of Rebbe Eliezer. Mi lom Rebbe Eliezer kaspo hamyuchad lo. Did not Rebbe Eliezer say that as far as Yom or Yomayim was concerned, that in order to establish ownership, you have to be considered the exclusive owner? Hochanami, so too, regarding the din of shein v'ayin, the limb freedom halacha, avdo hamiyuchad lo. It would have to be your exclusive slave. If it's not yours exclusively, so then the din of shein v'ayin will not apply. That is the approach that Rebbe Eliezer would take, and hence this source would be in accordance with Rebbe Eliezer. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access Marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.